Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the horrific terror attack on the Crocus City Concert Hall just outside Moscow on Friday evening. At least 137 people were killed, and the extremist group Islamic State claimed responsibility for the deadliest terror attack in Russia since the Beslan hostage crisis 20 years ago. We will also touch on the Russian election, which ended on March 17th with a predictable official result of 87%, a little over 87% for Putin, extending his rule into 2030. And my guest on The Week Ahead in Russia today is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin, The Weaponization of Everything, and Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. Thanks very much for joining me, Mark.
Well, it was a pleasure, even if at the moment in rather sad circumstances.
Yes, indeed. So much bad news coming out of Russia and of course, Ukraine in recent weeks in particular. But good to have you on the show again. Now, for over 2 years, the main topic on this podcast most weeks has been the war in Ukraine, Russia's war against Ukraine. This time, the subject is something that happened in Russia and has no apparent connection to Ukraine, although we'll get to Moscow's claims about that shortly. But I just want to mention that Russia's invasion of Ukraine did continue over the weekend with large-scale attacks on Kyiv and other areas, and with Ukrainians struggling to restore power to more than a million people left without it after strikes on Kharkiv and other targets. Now, about the terror attack on Crocus City Hall on Friday evening. This is or was a concert venue at a prominent mall complex in what can probably be called an upscale area on the northwestern edge of Moscow. Gunmen entered the building before a rock concert and opened fire in the entrance and in the auditorium itself, a horrific scene. There were blasts and a fire, and the building was very heavily damaged, essentially destroyed. Authorities say 137 people were killed and more than 150 were injured. This was the first major attack of its kind in Russia, I believe, since 2017, and by far the deadliest in almost 20 years since the Beslan school hostage crisis in September 2004, which ended with more than 330 people dead, more than half of them children. Mark, for my first question, I'm going to refer back to Beslan. After that attack, Putin put some of the blame on Washington and the West, insinuating that they were supporting Islamic militants in the North Caucasus in an effort to weaken or destroy Russia, the latter part of which has been, of course, a common accusation or theme of Putin's over the ensuing 20 years that the West is out to hold Russia back and essentially destroy it. In his first public remarks on the Crocus City Hall attack, which came more than 18 hours after the attack, he claimed, without providing evidence, that Ukraine had provided a window, quote, on the border between Russia and Ukraine, to enable the attackers to try to escape. And there's been plenty of propaganda in the Russian media pointing the finger at Ukraine. Kyiv has adamantly denied any involvement. And of course, Islamic State has claimed responsibility, and the U.S. Has said that has indicated that it believes IS was behind it. Mark, what do you think about these Russian insinuations? And also, what about those who say Russia could have staged this as a false flag? After all, Putin has used terror attacks in the past as a pretext to clamp down on dissent inside Russia.
Yeah, we tend to obviously come back to these false flag allegations, particularly because of the 1999 apartment bombings that in so many ways ease the way for a relatively unknown Putin to become president. However, just because there was that one particular case, we shouldn't assume that everything that happens is a false flag, to be perfectly honest. Some people in the wonderful and deranged world of social media do. If one looks at many of the kind of the specific data points that people claim demonstrate that there was something iffy about it, I mean, I think it's very quickly break down. The idea that, oh, well, there were no security guards at Crocus. Well, we know that there were. The Agalarovs, the owners, have said so. At least one of them, I think, has died, was killed in the attack. And we have other cases of some security guards leading people to safety and so forth. So that's not true. The idea that, well, it's impossible given the density of security in cameras and everything else in Moscow. Well, let's face it, you know, even highly secure areas are vulnerable, and particularly Crocus. I mean, it's not actually in Moscow. It's in this sort of almost commuter belt town just outside the Ring Road. So it's not really in the sort of the main security zone. And as regards the suggestion that it took an hour for any emergency services to arrive, even though there's a base of the National Guards, Amon Riot Police, just about 10-minute drive down the road. Well, I mean, apart from the fact that, in fact, it seems to have taken more like 30, 35 minutes for them to arrive, and the terrorists were out in 20, 25 minutes. But more to the point, look, it escapes the sort of notice of people that, you know, these things take time. It takes time for some people to raise the alarm, for people to realize quite what's going on, for orders to be given, for the special weapons forces to be mobilized, issued their guns, loaded up into vans, and so forth. Actually, you know, basically what we have seen is really what one could have expected. And more to the point, one always has to look at sort of motivation. Look, Putin at the moment, I don't think needs pretexts or mandates. He's just awarded himself, after all, an 87% vote in the presidential elections. He, frankly, is doing every vicious thing he can to the Ukrainians, pretty much. It's not like there's some key escalation. I think it's highly unlikely that this would be used as a sort of pretext for some kind of national mobilization, unless he was already sort of planning it. So given that actually he ends up looking quite weak out of this, because there's not going to be some kind of great sort of cathartic outcome, I think we can set aside the false flag notion, just as we can set aside the Ukraine element. To be sure, both KHUR, Ukrainian military intelligence, and the SBU, the Ukrainian security service, have been carrying out what we could call sort of terrorist tactic operations within Russia, sometimes precisely by recruiting dupes or blackmailing them into attacks. But nonetheless, although it didn't help that KHUR spokesman immediately claimed that this was in fact a Russian operation, that it was a false flag operation, nonetheless, there is absolutely no evidence that Ukraine had any responsibility in this. And I think that in that case, this is just classic Putin just using it as an opportunity to demonize them. In fact, this is, I think, exactly what it looks like. Islamic State Khorasan, which is the sort of affiliate in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Central Asia, has long regarded the Russian crusaders as being their main target. They've carried out a variety of terrorist attacks in Russia over recent years, and indeed seem to have been behind. There was a case on the 7th of March that the FSB prevented, which was going to be an armed attack on a synagogue in Kaluga. So look, you know, these are people who clearly have the means to carry out terrorist operations, particularly armed terrorist operations. They clearly had the desire to do so. And indeed, not only have they claimed credit, but they have also demonstrated, you know, a certain amount of information about the attack. So, you know, when it comes down to it, yes, it's depressing that everyone will choose to default to their favored conspiracy theory. But in practice, it clearly is what it seems to have been.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm just going to follow up on that by mentioning the fact, I think you mentioned this in your podcast yesterday, that Putin, when he finally did come out and make a statement about this attack, again, about 18, 19 hours after it had begun, I guess, and was over, he he made no mention of Islamic State, let alone Islamic State Khorasan, even though IS had already claimed responsibility. And he did, again, you know, the only country or entity that he did mention was Ukraine. So, I mean, why do you think that is? You know, and there had also been a U.S. Warning a couple weeks earlier about, you know, potential IS attacks, although I guess that covered the 48-hour period, so not including, you know, not it was a bit of a time ago. But why do you think Putin avoided mention of Islamic State?
I mean, look, I think it's a combination of things. It may well be precisely embarrassment, having sort of so publicly just a few days earlier criticized America for its warning, saying that, in fact, it was all a sort of a provocation and an attempt at intimidation. Maybe he didn't actually want to admit, yeah, okay, fair enough, maybe it was Islamic State after all. Secondly, I think there is a clear political desire to use this precisely to vilify the Ukrainians. You know, we've got to remember that his war in Ukraine is really not a broadly popular war. Doesn't mean to say that most Russians are actively opposed to it, but certainly the actual support for it is small and probably, it's hard to tell, diminishing. So from his point of view, any time he can adduce something as evidence that, in fact, Kyiv is in the grip of a neo-Nazi terroristic state, the better for him. But perhaps most importantly is actually, otherwise, this is a serious policy dilemma here. If he says, yes, this was Islamic State operating through the medium of Central Asian residents and guest workers, then firstly, it aggravates racial tensions, which actually is a problematic issue in a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional state like the Russian Federation, where 10% of the population is Muslim. But it also actually then begs the question, so what are you going to do about it? And the inevitable corollary would be some kind of crackdown on the Central Asians, which, as we know from past experience, would be handled in a fairly thuggish and insensitive way. And at the moment, Russia cannot afford to alienate and drive out these Central Asian workers. It needs them. It needs them to do the work that, frankly, there aren't Russians to do, or that Russians don't want to do. I mean, at the moment, there is a labor crisis between the impact of the war and the need to have the defense factories running at full pelt. There is actually sort of a shortage of labor. So to actually exacerbate that by risking driving Central Asians out of the country, that actually would directly impact his war effort and also have diplomatic implications with his relationship with the Central Asian countries, who are feeling much, much less intimidated by Moscow now, and again, which Moscow needs, because these are crucial routes for sanctions-busting smuggling into Russia of all kinds of spare parts, materials, microchips, whatever, that, again, the war effort needs. So in this respect, I think he was afraid, frankly, of pointing the finger at the Central Asians. They have become, in some ways, the new Navalny, the threat which he dare not speak their name. And therefore, he just defaulted to these, frankly, rather other lackluster and unconvincing claims about some sort of unspecified Ukrainian connection.
All right. That's very fascinating. And thanks for that. My second question has a few strands. As I mentioned, this was the first major attack of its kind in Russia since April 2017. 7 years ago, when 15 people were killed in a blast on the subway in St. Petersburg. So I'm wondering, one, kind of why has this happened now? Two, does Russia now face, and you spoke a little bit about this just now, but does Russia now face a major new or revived threat of militant attacks? And three, how are Putin and the government likely to respond? I mean, we had his words, But how are they really likely to respond, you know, going forward, both within Russia and in terms of any actions abroad or any change in the way Moscow is waging its war against Ukraine?
I think we have to recognize that Russia has continued to face a terrorist threat. Again, it just tends not to be in the news because obviously it's not as kind of horrifically high profile and bloody, or else, in fact, as with that synagogue attack, they are forestalled by the authorities. But this is it. This is actually a constant low-level issue. And, you know, why now? Look, I think these tend to be opportunistic rather than anything else. We often have a tendency to look, well, is there some particular significance? You know, in many cases, it's just when there are people who have been either groomed or who have radicalized themselves to the pitch where they're willing to carry out an attack, where often the odds of survival or escape are actually relatively limited. That's then you take advantage of that. You can't just kind of bank that and say, well, we'll come back to you maybe in 18 months when we have a particular operation in mind, because, you know, the emotions tend to die down if they're not exploited. So one can point to certainly some factors that might have contributed. You know, it may well be, as some have suggested, that in fact the security forces have been rather distracted by the sort of two priorities coming down from the Kremlin, which is Ukrainian sabotage attacks and the domestic political opposition. But I think that only goes so far. The FSB is a pretty massive organization. It's not like it doesn't still have people working on the counterterrorism beat. This is not, for example, like, you know, we saw after 9/11, where there was this sort of massive reorientation of the American internal law and order and security apparatus towards counterterrorism, which meant you did suddenly get people being yanked off, for example, the Russia counter-espionage desks, and being hurriedly retrained and sent to into new expanded counterterrorism elements. You know, we've not had that kind of structural reorientation of the FSB and so forth. So, you know, I think ultimately it's just one of these things that, unfortunately, the depressingly banal answer is these things will happen, and they will happen when they happen, because sometimes the terrorists will get through. Now, in the context of how Russia will respond, well, I think we can almost think of this in on three dimensions. One of them is assuming that they keep pushing this notion of the Ukraine dimension. And it's quite interesting that, yes, this is very much sort of coming out of the more the usual toxic, outspoken sort of Kremlin talking heads on television and the like, and also in the more tabloid press. But actually, the more professional observers and commentators are actually being a lot more restrained about this. They're certainly not saying that Ukraine was behind this. They are maybe accepting that there was an element of facilitating. But clearly, there is, well, actually, no, I say clearly, I have a suspicion that there is a degree of embarrassment within the more professional community about this fairly blatantly false claim. So what we might get is some kind of extra performative attack, as we've seen in the past, like when, say, the Kerch Bridge was downed. But again, it'll be maybe in the context of the current spate of Russian missile and drone attacks, you know, maybe they'll just announce that today's attacks are vengeance for Crocus, but, you know, probably won't really change anything. So that's it. I think in Ukraine, there isn't really much scope for escalation. In terms of domestic security, you know, a lot will depend on, frankly, how the politics of the situation emerges. We've seen these kind of horrific videos of security forces dealing with the alleged terrorists, one of them who seems to have his genitals attached to an electric battery, the other one who seems to have had part of his ear cut off and put in his mouth. And I suppose in part this may be an attempt to assuage the angers of the Russian population, which is understandable. If it doesn't work, if people are still calling for action, then just simply in order to satisfy the bayings of the majority, Putin may well be willing to actually countenance some kind of crackdown on a minority. So we still may well see him forced into a position where he has to do, again, some kind of bit of sort of performative bloodletting. I think he's trying to avoid it, but if that's what he'll do, that's what he'll do. And the third real issue in terms of the response is, it was striking when, before the terrorist attack, we had presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov make this interview with Argumenti Facti, which caused a certain amount of commotion because he used the W word relating to Ukraine, the word war. Now, some people are saying, this was Peskov admitting that Russia is at war. Well, that's not actually what he was saying. He was just simply reiterating the wider question about the fact that, as far as the Kremlin is concerned, what's happening in Ukraine, the special military operation, so-called, is just one part, one front of a wider war with the West. And you know, Putin had used that language in his State of the Union and so forth. It's nothing new. But the interesting thing about Peskov's interview, by my lights, was his mention about this notion of war being important in terms of sort of shaping Russian sense of their internal mobilization. That's, I think, a key element. The idea that Russians must now think themselves in a wartime footing where there is no more middle ground between patriots and traitors, and everyone must sort of push all their efforts. Now, in that context, again, the interesting thing is, what do Russians internalize about the threats facing them? Do they actually think that everything is about Ukraine and the West? Do they actually think this is about some kind of nasty, insidious terrorist attack? Or do they actually begin to think of Putin as having, as frankly, failing? He's already failed as the great provider because their quality of life is beginning to be impinged. Is he also failing as the great defender? And that, if that begins to take root, then I think we'll see the Kremlin being pushed into even more extreme actions to try and demonstrate to Russians that it is indeed still able to protect them from all of the enemies besieging them. But the point is, these are all things we're just going to have to watch play out in the coming weeks.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, what kind of actions might those be, do you think, if Putin and the Kremlin, you know, feel that Russians are starting to see him as a failure? I mean, there have been plenty of things that have happened, you know, since the summer with Prigozhin's mutiny, and now this attack. What do you think the Putin might try to do to kind of reassure Russians that he is the great protector?
Well, the interesting thing is that all the options are pretty much self-harming ones. I mean, obviously, we can expect a lot of security theater. We can expect a lot more uniforms on the streets and document checks and all that kind of thing, which actually have very little effect in terms of real security, but make people believe that things are being done. Beyond that, though, I mean, especially if actually it becomes harder and harder to sustain the Ukraine connection. I mean, when you've actually got, you know, visibly four Central Asians as your assassins, and also a sort of a support network who apparently are also largely or entirely drawn from Central Asian origins. People will quickly enough draw their own conclusions. I mean, already if you look at Russian social media, the Islamic State dimension and the ethnic dimension is being played up a lot. So Putin is not able to kind of capture the national debate in that way. Well, if he's going to act against that, I mean, I mentioned about the risks of some kind of crackdown on Central Asians.
Right.
We've also got people arguing that, in fact, you know, there should be an end to uncontrolled migration. Not that it is uncontrolled migration, but, you know, again, actually making it harder for Central Asians to come to Russia. There should be more security checks and document checks and so forth. Well, you know, that might be done. But if so, again, it's going to make it harder and less economically viable for people to come to Russia. We might even actually see people wanting to review the visa regulations relating to particularly Tajikistan, because the four individuals in question apparently are all of Tajik extraction, which is already worrying and annoying the Tajik authorities. So, you know, we may well see a series of moves which are essentially designed to satisfy Russians, but which in practice will both damage the Russian economy and damage Russia's standing with its crucial Central Asian allies.
Okay, thanks. That's a great explanation. And before we move back to the election, I just wanted to ask another question about the U.S. warning. You know, Putin really, you know, as you said, he dismissed kind of angrily and criticized the U.S. warning that there could be an attack. What does that say? I guess, what does that say about, you know, why do you think he did that? Obviously, this happened before the attack. But what is it? Why do you think he did that? And what does it say about, I guess, some relations between Russia and the West, obviously, and the U.S., obviously, in extremely bad shape. But in the past, they've listened to each other on these kind of warnings sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the Americans clearly gave this warning in good faith. However, Putin has a tendency to mirror image. And I suspect that just as he probably wouldn't hesitate to issue a bogus warning for political informational purposes, I think that when those 48 hours the warning appertained to, which was I think what the 8th and 9th of this month, mm-hmm. had passed without incident, I think he got angry and thought this is in fact an attempt by the Americans to sort of basically rattle Russians before the elections. Remember, well, one of the key Russian, or Kremlin rather, goals was precisely to ensure that there was a high turnout. And if people are worried that some place where you cluster together might become a terrorist attack, then conceivably it might have affected turnout. So, I mean, I think Putin sort of imputing on the Americans precisely the kind of goals that he might have had, decided to angrily sort of strike back. You know, it's also worth noting that, you know, we are in a position where we really don't know much about the nature of this warning. I mean, American sources are saying, oh, it was all pretty specific. Russian sources are saying it was all pretty generic. And the Americans also have been saying that they think that there's been a heightened risk from Islamic State Khorasan since November. Well, that was even months ago. Mm-hmm. To say, oh, well, there may be an attack, and it may be an attack on some large gathering, including concerts, and it may be at some point this month, you know, is not really very actionable. Now, as I said, I mean, at the moment, I have no idea. I have no idea whether, in fact, it was, we think it's going to be, you know, on a Friday in a major concert, which is actually quite usefully actionable, or whether it's very general. But the point is that regardless of what, as it were, the professionals might have thought, and there are some suggestions of a slightly increased police presence at some events and so forth this month. You know, it's clear that Putin himself had just convinced himself that those perfidious Americans could not possibly be actually passing on a good faith warning, and that it was all just some attempt to undermine his own triumph.
Okay, thanks. So the election does seem to have been a very probable factor. And on that note, let's discuss the election a bit. I'm going to keep it simple, but preface this by saying that the week before the 3-day vote, I was trying to guess the percentage that would be officially awarded to Putin. There had been many suggestions, you know, from officials and as well as analysts that the Kremlin was aiming for at least 80%. And I was thinking maybe 84 or 87%. I decided to guess 84%, but I was wrong. Turned out to be, I believe, 87.3. And now I'm not sure why I didn't go with the higher number. And I'll also mention that, you know, there are indications that up to, I guess, 22 million or even more than 30 million of the votes for Putin, which I believe is a little less than half. I could be wrong about that right now. Sorry about that. But a huge chunk of the votes for Putin, you know, may have been essentially fabricated, taken from others or just chalked up to Putin. But my question is, what's your main takeaway from this quite predictable process?
Well, you say predictable, but I mean, I do think that 87% figure was unpredictable. I think you obviously gave the Kremlin too much benefit of the doubt.
Yes.
Because, look, it is inherently implausible. And I think this is it. In past elections, there has been much, much more of an emphasis on trying to make the result look within the bounds of plausibility, shall we say. 87%, I think, is deliberately ridiculous. And that's, I think, the point. It's a flex. It's an attempt to basically challenge Russian society and say, look, of course we know this isn't the genuine result. And of course you know this isn't the genuine result. But accept that there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. And I do think this therefore marks that real kind of progression from an attempt at a sort of hybrid authoritarian regime, which actually did have surprisingly large amount of room for civil society at the bottom, but even for reflection of popular concerns and issues at the top, within its sort of very theatrical, manufactured dramaturgia of the political spectacle, to just outright authoritarianism with the shallowest of pretenses of laws and elections but essentially being one in which might makes right and the state has might on its side. So, I mean, I think in that respect, the 87% is important because precisely it's a symptom of a change that we've seen over recent years. But the second interesting point is precisely the issue you raised about the level of fraud and the potential that, you know, maybe up to half of Putin's votes were either manufactured, especially courtesy of electronic voting, or just simply reassigned from one of the other candidates to Putin. Now, in theory, that would suggest that actually Putin has, 43.5% or so of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, less than half. Which would be interesting because we have seen in a variety of polls before the election suggestions of putting him anything from 50-55% up to 60-65%. So actually it would suggest that the real vote is even lower than the polls were suggesting. In that context, and given that that was in an election in which it was clear there was no alternative, the other three candidates were, in their own ways, all grotesque or negligible political pygmies. It's almost like, well, why would one even bother voting other than for Putin, or just bother voting at all when you know the outcome? But nonetheless, a lot of people did not. So to me, perversely, I think it's an encouraging sign. It's encouraging that the Kremlin has to rig on such a scale, because it means that actually society is not supportive of Putin in anything like the kind of way that these results claim. And it's also positive in that, in some ways, we do have a degree of a mask being ripped off, and the last vestiges of the sort of the hybrid side of authoritarianism really dying away. Final point, though, that I would raise is this. And this is the kind of question we come back to so often in so many other different contexts. How much and what does Putin really know, though, about what's going on? I mean, I imagine that he doesn't genuinely believe that 87 point whatever percent of Russians actually wanted him elected. But I mean, have people broken down the results to him and said, look, actually, probably you got less than half of the real vote? Or, as in so many other areas, from whether it's, yes, absolutely, Vladimir Vladimirovich, Ukraine will fall within a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. to whatever else, are people just simply managing him, telling him the right truths just in order to keep him happy and keep him on track? Because, again, just with the disastrous decision to go into Ukraine, so too, if he actually has a massively sort of unrealistic notion of his support, and by extension, the legitimacy of the state as a whole, it makes it more likely that at some point down the line, and I'm not suggesting this is going to happen next Tuesday, but at some point down the line, he will likewise catastrophically mishandle domestic developments, because what he will do will make sense, but based on a whole series of inaccurate data points.
All right, Mark, thanks very much. Yeah, I mean, if you take sort of a direct maybe analogy, you know, he appears to have believed that many Ukrainians would welcome Russian forces with open arms. So, you know, if he makes the same kind of guess or assumption about Russians in some situation, you know, results could be bad for him. And I just want to just kind of try to wrap up. You mentioned the vote, this 87% vote, you know, shows Russians that there's no alternative. You know, you don't Putin's the one. But then on the other hand, aren't they getting quite a different message? You know, as you also mentioned, from this this terror attack, that okay, he's the man in control, but you know, this was not prevented. What's going on here?
Well, I would think exactly what it says is there is no alternative within this system. But on the other hand, this system is no longer delivering. You know, when it comes down to it, one has to recognize that for a large portion of the 24 years he has been in direct and indirect control of Russia, these have been pretty good years for Russians. I mean, especially, but not necessarily entirely, in comparison with the 1990s. They have had high levels of stability, and more to the point, a level of prosperity that they had never had at any point before. Now, I don't actually think Putin can be thanked for that. I don't think it's him that did it. He was the beneficiary. He was lucky, as in so many other ways. But nonetheless, you know, for a long time, Putin did seem to deliver on prosperity, stability, and security. Now he's not delivering. He's not delivering on prosperity, clearly. He's not delivering on stability either, frankly, and this is one of the lessons of the whole Prigozhin mutiny, and nor is he necessarily delivering on security. So the social contract has been broken. However, as these elections show, the idea that you can actually respond to that breach within the current political system is laughable. Now, again, this does not mean that imminently Russians are going to be coming out on the streets. But instead, I think what it means is precisely we will see Russians increasingly alienated, increasingly dissatisfied with the system. And although at present they don't really have anything to do with that, you know, so long as Putin seems to have control of the security apparatus, then most Russians are understandably not going to go out onto the streets because they, no more than the rest of us, are not actually the sort of heroes who are willing to, well, lie down in front of a tank on Tiananmen Square. So in that context, what you'll have is a continuing high level of, shall we say, protest potential. At some point in the future, there will be a moment when that may be liberated, whether it's because Putin dies or becomes ill or some other major crisis that actually sort of forces people into making tough decisions. But the point is, what we saw with the collapse of the regimes in the so-called Warsaw Pact countries of Central Europe is actually how quickly what seemed to be working and strong authoritarian regimes can collapse in the circumstances where over the years this protest potential has built up.
All right. We are going to, on that note, we're going to wrap it up here. Mark, thanks very much for your insights, and thank you for joining me this time.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin, The Weaponization of Everything, and Putin's Wars, From Chechnya to Ukraine. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Nye Strelyai, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.